You are listening to the Bad Duo back again in action, Adam and John on the Punk News Podcast number 215. Back to the Punk News Podcast. This is features editor John Gentile, and we're doing an old school style like we used to do back in the day. Just me and my main man, managing editor, the Chiefy Weefy. He's got a kid, he's got a beard, he's got a great Canadian punk collection. He is Mr. Adam W-H-I-T-E. Adam White, how are you tonight?
I am just kicking against the pricks, John, and... Was that like a really bad Johnny Cash reference? That was what I tried to make it.
Well, it's a Bible reference, technically.
Yeah. Everyone on Earth is sick right now, including my wife and my kid. And my kid earlier was sneezing in my food. And I've gone like 2 weeks in this gauntlet where every time I walk around a corner, I have to like duck and weave to avoid like a big green floating germ cloud. And I feel that it's getting me. I can feel it. It's in my throat. That's where the war is happening.
You know, I used to have, you know, people like try to avoid getting a cold. Like I'm trying to get a, I don't want to get a cold. I don't want to get a cold. I used to like welcome getting colds. Not that I liked having colds, but I would say, you know, I don't care if I get sick because colds are a virus. And once you get a virus, you can never get that same virus again because the virus never truly leaves your system. So I would like not try to avoid getting colds under the impression that I eventually would become immune to all colds because I've had them all. But it doesn't work that way at all.
Well, I mean, it would if the cold virus never mutated or anything like that. Right? Like, if it was the same cold virus and never changed, you know, walk up one day, get on a bus, lick the pole, you'd probably be good. But I don't think that's how it works. I don't know. I am a practicing microbiologist, but it's hard sometimes to keep all that straight.
I'm only an amateur microbiologist myself.
Mm. Who's a microbiologist? Is it the guy from The Offspring? I want to say it was him.
There's like a lot of guys that are microbiologists. Like, isn't Milo like an organic chemist or something like that?
Yeah, well, one of them is. I forget what. Let's see here. What is Dexter Holland?
Doesn't Dexter Holland like own like a couple of jets too?
He's a really interesting guy. I don't like his band at all, but he is an interesting guy.
And he has a hot sauce company.
Yeah, I figure everybody has a hot sauce company, though, at this point. Isn't that a thing you do? You get to be a certain point in your life, you start a hot sauce company. I knew a guy that started a hot sauce company.
Yeah, it's funny. Like Dexter Holland's in one of the most financially successful punk bands of all time. He's got a doctor. He owns jets. And I'm like, he's got a hot sauce, Adam. A hot sauce.
Yeah, I know.
But Milo Aukerman has postdoctoral research in biochemistry. Like, that's heavy-duty stuff. Postdoctoral research? That's heavy-duty stuff, man. Wait, he works at DuPont in Delaware? He lives like 5 miles from my house.
Let's see. All right, yeah. So Dexter Holland, he's a PhD in molecular biology.
Wow. Wait, when did he get that? Like, he's not that old, right? Isn't he only like 45?
He's 48.
Yeah. So I mean, like, and wasn't Offspring like super popular 20 years ago? Like, isn't that like the when Offspring was most popular?
Let's see. As of 2013, he was a doctoral student.
Wait, so he became a doctor after Offspring?
Yeah, it seems like.
Well, kudos to him, man. Viral oncology. That's urine, isn't it? Isn't that oncology? Urine?
This I do not.
Blood. I think oncology is blood. I think that's
blood. Let's say it's urine because it's way more fun.
It's tumors. It's tumors. He's a doctoral student for tumors, basically.
All those people that complain that we talk about things that we don't know about are right now just like hitting their hitting their iPhones up to their heads and being like, why are they talking about this?
But this is fun because we're going on an information adventure. You know, like when you watch Reading Rainbow or whatever, they're like, if you ever want to go on an adventure, go to the library. Well, that's what we're doing. You're going on the library with Adam and John as they learn about what punk rockers have PhDs.
As we read Wikipedia and try desperately to figure out what's what various things mean.
And isn't it Mr. Greg has a PhD?
Mr. Greg has a PhD. Mr. Greg is like the coolest degree too, because it's like he's like an evolutionary. I think he's an evolutionary biologist.
Yeah, isn't it interesting how all these guys that have PhDs are all scientists?
Yeah, there's not a lot of like
anthropology, of geology
that I know. Well, what's his name?
Joel Tannenbaum has a PhD of Plow United.
No, he is a... Is he a psychologist?
Joel? I don't even know what Joel... I think Joel actually does something with language or something. I don't even know, man. Or economics, maybe?
The, what's his name? Dan Yemen from Paint of Black and...
Lifetime, Kid Dynamite.
Kid Dynamite and all his other bands... most importantly, Armalite with Adam Gorin. I am pretty sure. Yeah, he has a doctorate in psychology. So there you go. Like he's a practicing child and teen psychologist in Philly.
I interviewed him about that once. I said to him, "Do you ever have parents like not want to use you because you're a punk rocker?" And his response to me was quite. I thought he would say, "Well, I keep those two things separate." His response to me is, "I don't have interest in working with people that are." He didn't say threatened, bothered by that, which I thought was extremely interesting. But speaking of Milo, did you know that the Descendants are releasing a documentary, which already been released, but they're doing a wide release of it? The film Filmage is going to be getting a bi-coastal release party on September 29, which will already have happened by the time you heard this, but it's going out on DVD this fall. The punk news leaders love the Descendants. Pretty much every punk rocker loves the Descendants. I was listening to them today. There's two real questions here. The first question is, are you excited to see this film? Have you seen this film? The second is you know, for the past 5 or so years, it was a big deal that you could see the Descendants because they hadn't played for a number of years, like a lot of years. Now they're playing pretty regularly. Has the specialness of the Descendants worn off?
I don't know. I don't think I've been in the same time and place as one of these Descendants shows yet, so hasn't worn off for me. Milo aside, those guys have all been involved in various bands that people would have probably seen play. So I guess it's not, you know, it's not like they're a bunch of hermits that all of a sudden reemerged. So that's a kind of what I've always liked about them, though, is I mean, there's something that's very not hero worshipy about Descendants for some reason. That was really the worst phrasing I can come up with. But, you know, there are certain bands that you would never expect to get back together, and then when they do, it becomes a huge deal. There's a huge cult of personality about it. You know, that it's, even if they were not back when they were active, considered rock stars, all of a sudden they're treated like rock stars. I get that a lot of people love Descendants and everything, but I've never had that felt that there's that air about them, which is kind of cool, which I guess kind of speaks to the band's overall aesthetic. So, you know, I would still be super excited to see them. I think people should still be super excited to see them. So there's that. I have not seen Filmage yet. I really want to. I assume if it's going to be released, it's going to show up on like Netflix and things like that too, which would be cool. But yes, I am looking forward to see that. I have realized though, is that I really like the idea of seeing. Sorry, there was like a giant phone ding as my phone was basically propping my mic up. What I really like and I would love to see is something like this in a communal setting. You really get the opportunity to kind of see any kind of like music documentary or anything like that, like in a theater. Okay, I'll preface this. In small town everywhere where I live, you never get to see that kind of shit in the theater. I'm sure in the big fancy city, Philadelphia, you guys have like people screening all kinds of wacky things in actual theaters, but not so much here. So I would love to see something like that. They do things like that at Pooza. And the 1 year at Poozafest, they were screening, what was it called? The other F word.
Mm.
The punk rock dads thing, at the one theater. And like, you could like walk into the theater and like grab a beer and some like super burnt popcorn and then go sit in this little community theater with a bunch of like other punk rockers and watch these documentaries like in the afternoon when there wasn't like a whole ton of like shows going on yet. It was really cool and chill and great to see. And I mean, personally, my wife was pregnant with my first child, my only child at that point. And,
Adam, did you just reveal something?
No. And I totally, like, no one knew. Well, Kira knew. I told Kira while we were at the, while we were there. But, it was great to go watch the other F word in this theater while I was, like, on my little sojourn from, like, the reality that I had to go home to. So, yeah, I love seeing that stuff in that setting. It'd be cool to see something like this that way.
Are you saying that punk rock DVDs are, oh, I'm just going out for a pack of cigarettes, I'll be back? Is that what it is for you?
I'm saying nothing.
Adam, what are your favorite punk rock documentaries?
See, my answer to this is going to be the most cliched things, because to me, they're the most cliched things. Like,
End of the Century?
End of the Century, West Way to the World, the Clash one.
Mm.
And I actually really, really like The Filth and the Fury.
That is a good one. That's a very good one. I'm a huge fan of all those. I am also a big fan of a newer one by who's the guy that has all the photos? Oh, I can't remember his name. Is it Friedman? I think it's Glenn. I think it might be Glenn Friedman. Maybe it's not by Glenn Friedman. It's My Life is a Jerk, the Circle Jerks documentary. It just came out, like, I don't know, a year or two ago. It's really good, because my favorite it seems there's two kinds of documentaries. There's ones where it's just a bunch of talking heads that talk about the band and say how great they are, but you don't learn anything actual quantifiable. Everything is, you know, amorphous. It's like, oh, everything changed when this band came around. Whereas the My Life is a Jerk, the Circle Jerks one, it's really just the band telling the story of the different phases of the band with the occasional interjection from a third party. And that's my, like, I appreciate punk rock documentaries as a certain instructional course about a band, telling you about the history of the band. I get kind of bored, or I think it's kind of pointless, when it's just a bunch of people saying how they love this certain band, you know?
Actually, one of the ones that I thought was incredibly entertaining, and I think in retrospect has become so, I don't know how it would play now, was the documentary on Against Me that came out via FAT, I think. I think it was called We're Never Going Home.
Yeah, that's the live album, and I believe it's a documentary too.
It was a documentary where I mean, so this was, I mean, put yourself way back. So this was, you know, way before the Laura Jane thing came to light, but even before that, this is before they signed to Sire. And the whole documentary was about, like, major label A&R people chasing them around and trying to get them to sign. And they never outright come out in it and make, like, this grand statement that, like, we're indie forever kind of thing. But there was definitely that undercurrent to it, especially because, like, it was something that was released on FAT. And just to go back and to kind of look at it, not only in light of you know, the Laura Jane Grace transition, but the fact that that was like pre them getting onto the major label and releasing New Wave and all the controversy that came with that, that's kind of crazy. It's kind of interesting that it's that much of a ground level thing where they're following them around and they're listening to the A&R guy pitch them and stuff like that. It's not so retrospective, and it's a bunch of, like, you know, talking heads basically being like, oh, Against Me back in the day where, you know, the kids loved them. It's none of that so much. It's really following them around. So I remember, like, when I watched it, I thought it was very well put together. It was very engaging. Now it would be really weird to go back and rewatch that now.
You know what's weird about that is now we're, I guess, almost 10 years. I think that's 2006. We're almost 10 years removed from that. What's interesting about that is that's kind of like the last gasp of the music industry, is this gigantic thing where they're like, we want to give you money, Against Me. Let us give you money. What's funny is that, like, so often you have bidding wars over these bands, and not commenting on the quality of the band at all, because I think their newest album is their best by far. But I can almost guarantee you that the major label lost money on Against Me.
Yeah, I can't imagine that. You're right. You're right about that being sort of at the end of that era when all of a sudden bands got chunks of money thrown at them for a little return. I mean, another great example for that would be like the Bronx. Like, I don't know how much A&R money Island put into the Bronx, but as great as I think those first few Bronx records were, I can't imagine that they really made any money on that. I mean, who did that play to outside of like people in the punk scene?
No one.
There weren't Bronx songs, you know. They weren't playing like Heart Attack American or is that them? Was that them or was that other stupid band? I'm gonna say that was them. Sure. There weren't people playing songs from that first Bronx record, whatever they happen to be called, you know, on the radio or anything like that. I mean, like, I don't understand how the label was even expecting to make money off that. I guess, like, you know, hopefully these songs get in a video game and we get some royalties off of that. I don't know. You don't feel like that happens that much these days. I haven't heard about any bands that we care about, really, that have had, like, bidding wars about them in a long time.
Well, actually, it's interesting you bring that up because, frankly, rock music, not commenting on creative-wise, sales-wise, rock music is way, 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 way down from where it was 10 years ago. Way down. There are still bidding wars for hip-hoppers. Like Iggy Azalea? Azalea? You know her? Adam?
Yeah, only in that I have no idea what she sounds like. I just remember that there were all these articles I kept reading online that were like, oh, I don't know what, like, they would say, they would list, like, a handful of people, and they would call them by, like, first name or whatever, and they would say, like, I don't know what Miley or Justin or Iggy is thinking about this, and I'd be like, why are they lumping Iggy in here? Like, why is he involved?
There will only ever be one Iggy, and he's an old dude that takes off his shirt. But the point is she was involved in a bidding war. I believe Kendrick Lamar was as well. But I think even now that music, like, labels don't have as much money, bidding wars aren't the same as they used to be. Bidding wars used to be, we'll give you, you know, a $2 million advance, you know, and the other guy's like, we'll give you a $2.5 million advance. Now, I think because there isn't that much money to be had, the structure of the deal is entirely different, and they don't just throw a whole bunch of cash at you, you know. So I think that's where we're at. But that's good and it's bad. It's good because people aren't as dependent on labels anymore by far. I mean, pretty much most bands in our scene put out records themselves, or they just get a small label to do it. It's bad because no bands are making any money at all. You know, like I said, I would bet if this was 1996 or even 2004 that Classics of Love would still be around because they'd be making way more money.
There is some degree to which I'm a little bit iffy about that, though, because...
Well, really? Oh, Classics of Love or the money thing?
Oh, fuck Classics of Love. No. No, what I mean is... just on the money thing, like, yeah, it'd be great if bands were making money from legitimate album sales and stuff like this, but, like, I'm gonna put on, like, my entirely unpunk kind of, like, small business person hat here, and...
I gotta interrupt you, Adam. One cannot say small business is not punk. Because if small business is not punk, that means Discord Records is not punk.
I know. I grew up with so much punk telling me that I had to be like a raging socialist to do anything, that whenever I like put on my capitalist hat, I feel a little bit icky. But what I like to see is when a thing, whether that thing is a band or a small business in this case, actually gets out and works really hard and figures out how to make money and then makes that money and makes it honestly. So you go out, you figure whatever your product, your service, or in this case, your music is, and you figure out how to connect with people and you sell it and you grind and you make that happen. And I like that. It makes me feel good. What I don't quite like in the business world is when we see things like, you know, like government subsidies or something like that come in, and where you or this all this venture capital stuff that you see happening with like the tech industry right now, where you have these companies that like don't actually make money, don't actually have a business model, don't actually like have anything sustainable, but someone is speculating that maybe one day they will, so they've given them, you know, $3 million, And I look at that and I'm like, that's not too different from, you know, from, what's it called? MCA Records or something going and giving H2O a whole bag of money on the anticipation that they're going to be the next Blink-182. Like, yeah, good for H2O that you got paid, but you didn't really get paid real money for doing real stuff. Like, someone that's overly rich gave you like a bag full of imaginary money on spec. And whenever it's that, I mean, like, yeah, that's cool that you got paid. I get that, especially if you're a starving band and everything. But I don't know. I feel like, wouldn't it be nicer to actually, you know, come by that money, you know, as reward for doing good work, as opposed to, you know, getting it because, you know, someone has made a bad bet on you?
I agree. However, may I counter that the problem is with bands, maybe not so much as businesses now, but with bands, there is almost no correlation between good band and good money.
Mm.
Do you disagree?
No, that's true. At least not good money in the way that, hey, we're going to retire on this. You can be a good band and definitely, I think, make money playing shows and selling merch and stuff like that. Like, I've got to imagine that, like, I mean, I got to imagine that, like, a band like Fucked Up, say.
They're making good money.
They're making good money in that, like, they have a good deal, I imagine, with a, you know, with one of the bigger major labels. They release records that people are excited about because they're legitimately good. And in the meantime, they put out lots of little releases for collectors and stuff like that. Lots of merch, lots of, you know, they sell a lot of different, like, clothing and shit like that at their shows. And you know, their shows seem to be well attended. And they don't overplay certain markets so that, you know, when they show up, people go to the shows and stuff like that. Like, as far as, like, how a band is run, they seem to be like a well-run band, so I imagine that they're at least making something off it. I don't really have any illusions that they're making any more than you could being like a fry cook, but you know, they are making something.
Actually, I think they're probably making a little bit more than that, because I this is not talking out of school. On Twitter, I think Damien Abraham talked about how he bought a house. So I'm glad that Damien Abraham is making enough money to buy a house off his band. You know, good for him if it's a good band.
Cool. Yeah, yes and no, but Damien was also hosting that show on Much Music for a little while. So that might have been a little bit of TV. You know, you got to find out, like, if Jonah Falco is buying a house.
Good point. Last thing on this point, I think. Adam, how long do you think Effed Up will last? How much longer do you think we have for Effed Up?
I was a little bit worried with their kind of quasi hiatus that they went on before Glass Boys came out, and only because they started to get lumped with, like, way too much. I don't know. There was a lot of anticipation after the last one, after Davey Comes to Life, right? And God, I hate to compare them to this, because this makes me sound like a total asshole, and it's not really apt. But it's the same kind of shit that kind of, like, Green Day fell into after American Idiot. We're like, I don't like American Idiot at all, but it was this big, huge, you know, artistic statement. Whether it was a good artistic statement or not is really up to you. But it was that, and then what do you do from there? Now, in Green Day's case, they made a further, even more horrible artistic statement and then just released a bunch of crap all at the same time. So bad for them, but I could imagine the pressure that you're under when you've done something that is seen as, you know, really super ambitious. So let's say David Comes to Life is that. Well, then what do you really do after that? So there's a little bit of, like, are they going to collapse under the pressure? But Glass Boys was very nicely unencumbered by it.
You know who's the master of that? David Bowie.
Hmm.
But continue, please.
Yeah, but so I feel like they've got the monkey off their back. So, you know what? They may go away for 6 months or a year or 2 years, but they're probably just going to, you know, we're going to go take a break and then we'll come back later. And they're not going to make a big announcement about it or anything like that. They'll just be on a break, and it won't really seem like any different to anyone right now. They just won't be a new album out, and they won't be touring. And then they'll kind of keep going for a little while. That's my thought.
Mm. I like your rosy picture of the future as Effed Up as sort of a collective that, you know, come together once in a while and put something out, goes away and comes back. I enjoy that.
I mean, well, we got to seg this into talking about DOA.
Yeah, I was going to be myself. Go ahead, Adam. Take it away.
So, DOA, the infamous, the veteran, the, well, I guess famous, not just infamous, Canadian punk act, long-running Canadian punk act, is now not breaking up. They were. So Joe Shithead Keithley, he went out and he made a statement. He said, "When I lost my nomination by 5 votes, and the backstory to this is that he was running for the provincial parliament in I forget which riding it was, but it was in British Columbia. Anyways, he said, "When I lost my nomination by 5 votes, I was pissed. But I soon realized that I had not forgotten how to write songs, how to sing and play guitar, and how to kick ass on stage. So I'm ramping up DOA again, and we're going to let our street politics tell the stories about what's really happening." So, yeah, so there you go. So Keith Lee's going back out. The band is now him, Patty Dudley on drums, and Mike Hostel on bass. Yeah.
Go ahead. Yes.
What'd I do?
Oh, you said bass like a southerner. You said like on bass.
On bass, yeah.
Mike Hostel on bass.
This is my cold coming in. I become like a southern gentleman when I'm sick. So. They're planning to release a whole new album again, March 2015 for this one. They had one that came out called Northern Avenger that was out not this year, but the year before.
They had one after that too. I think Northern Avenger might actually be Joey's solo band. The one that came out after that was We Come in Peace, which actually had a pretty cool track with Jello Biafra called We Occupy.
My God, DOA releases a lot of records.
They do. And now it was a ska number too. Is Jello and Joey doing ska? And it's great. It's a lot of fun.
So DOA is still around. I'm not sure what I think about DOA these days.
Well, let me tee us off, and then you can respond. Yeah. Is first of all, I like DOA. I like what DOA stands for. I saw DOA about a year ago. It was their quote final tour, but of course it wasn't. But DOA is kind of broken up. Has had like 3 final tours now. But it was awesome. I was happy to get to see them because I never saw them before. They kind of just did what DOA does, you know, 2.5 minute bang bang bang, you know, hard rock and punk rock song. I was fun. It was great. What I thought was interesting is on I guess punk news, a lot of people were like mad that they were like not staying broken up or whatever, a couple of people say on the Facebook, it's like DOA sucks. I don't know what there is to hate about DOA. I can see being indifferent to DOA, but people were like angry at, like, I don't know what sucks about DOA. They're like one of the earliest, if not the earliest, Canadian punk rock band, and you know they're pretty important punk rock wise, especially touring wise. And, I mean, at least their first few records are really, really good. So I don't know what there is to hate about DOA. That really surprised me. But I will say this, though, is DOA is great. Those first few albums are great. But I guess the issue is I don't know if DOA has really challenged themselves. New DOA songs sound exactly like old DOA songs. Now, people say the Ramones, they're great because they never really changed their sound or deviated. I don't even know if that's true. I think there's actually quite a bit of deviation in Ramones tunes. But going back to DOA, has DOA stayed true to the punk rock ethos, or have they phoned it in at some points?
I'm sure there's been periods of phone in, but oh wow, Northern Avenger was their 4th last record. Shit. okay, it tells you how on top of it I am. I think part of the problem with DOA is that they've got a little bit of the anti-flag problem.
What do you mean, too simplified?
Well, that's how they come off, right? So let's say you're like put yourself in the shoes of like some kid that's getting into punk rock now. You are a weird, rare person in the first place, so good for you. But you're getting into punk rock. Let's say you came in via, I don't know, like your brother got you into the Menzingers or something like that, right? And, you know, so you like this music. It's fun. You can jump around. It's speaking to all of your, like, teenage anxieties. Great. And you start going in and you start researching kind of, like, old punk rock and things like that. When you look at the way that, say, like, that DOA is packaged, it's a lot easier to look at them and go, like, wow, this band looks like a bunch of old goofs compared to how to how, or like, compare it to how, like, I know they're not together anymore, so they haven't had the same exposure, but, like, compare it to how, like, say, like, you see, like, old pictures of Minor Threat or something like that, right? Where they're all sitting around, they look really cool, and they look really indifferent, like, you know, they don't give a shit, they're not dressed up super punk or anything like that, but, like, Ian always kind of looks like he's thinking of something, that he's mad, you know, or you see someone that's on the other end of, like, the punk rock flamboyancy scale, and you see, like, you know, Hank Rollins back in the day, right, where he just looks like he's mad, and he's, you know, he's not wearing a shirt, and he's covered in tattoos, and he's, you know, just crazy looking and all this. And then you look at, like, a picture of Joe Keithley, and, like, Joe Keithley's, like, kind of like a tall, lanky guy. He's sort of weird. He kind of looks like your friend's dad, you know, and he's wearing, you know, like denim on denim or whatever, and his own band shirt a lot of the times. And
only he and Iron Maiden are allowed to do that.
Yeah. And I mean, I love Joe Keithley, but you got to look at it that way and be like, this isn't necessarily cool. I mean, like, shit, look at the picture of them that we've got up on Punk News right now. Joe's wearing like a sleeveless black t-shirt of his own band. He looks totally like he does not want to be sitting there smiling for a picture, and he's being forced to do it. He's got one guy behind him that's wearing like a CBGB shirt, which again is seen as cliche, and making like a growly face. He's got another guy behind him with huge locks of flowing hair.
I think that guy looks cool, Adam. I think that guy looks kind of like a biker or something.
Or like he was in a new wave band. But
well, honestly, but, he also could be like in Warrant or something cheesy like that. You know, like what's that band with the two twin brothers with blonde hair? Is it Winger? Not Winger. Well, you know, that band.
That band, yeah. Right?
Nelson.
So they've got that. So you look at them, and then when you look at them, so let's say that's your first impression as you see the visual there, right? And then you look and you see what the names of the songs are and things like that, and it strikes you as like, oh, this is like really cliche, kind of like, you know, vaguely lefty protest punk, you know, of the kind that you'd expect it to be, like the kind that, like, if you were to sit around and, like, you know, hey John, let's make a punk rock album, okay, it's going to be called Street Action, and the first song is going to be called, you know, Protest in the Streets, and the second song will be called, you know, Molotov Cocktail of Truth, and the third song will be called, and you can just sit there and, like, make up punk songs. That's how a lot of that reads. Now, DOA is the real deal. They were around at the start. They basically created a lot of that thing. So a lot of what we consider, like, you know, that we joke about being like, oh, that's like this goofy street punk thing that we can't really take seriously, or that's this kind of like goofy protest punk thing we can't take seriously. Well, like, they own that. They created that shit. They're at least one of the originators of it. So it's totally cool that they're the ones still doing it. But I gotta say that, like, if I'm that 16-year-old or whatever, and I'm coming in because I heard the Menzingers, I could totally see that they look like that. And that's got to color what people think, so I imagine.
You're saying that DOA has not aged well. Is that what you're saying?
DOA was not a pretty band in the first place, and they've only aged worse. So, well, it's fair. One of those. I mean, but hey, compare that to the other story that came up recently that you posted about, the Eddie and the Hot Rods one, right?
Yes, Eddie and the Hot Rods.
So like, go take a look at the photo we got of them that's up there that came with the thing, right? You know, it's a little bit of the situation where, you know, they've got some younger ringers, you know, that are in the band. But, you know, hell, frontman still looks, you know, Eddie looks kind of cool to me.
He does. He's got like that blue leather jacket and the glasses and stuff. They do look pretty cool, don't they? So you're saying that they're just caring more about how they look?
It's not their care. Some people age very well. I don't think Joe Keithley does. But I mean, some people manage to kind of grow into it and not seem a little bit awkward. Like, I always thought that, like Joe always seems like a little bit awkward that way. Not that it's his fault or anything. It's just the look of the guy, right? And you see, like a guy like Jello, who's kind of aged into, like, the cool old uncle, right?
A crazy old uncle, yeah.
A crazy old uncle, right? And then you see, like, a guy like Keith Morris who just, like, doesn't age. He just, like, slowly, like, calcifies into being more awesome, right?
But they're both so lovable. See, Jello and both Keith and Jello have that spark of mischievousness, which makes you want to hang out with them. Joey's more serious, you know. Joey doesn't have that yuck to him.
Yeah, so I gotta say that's probably like a good deal of it is that, you know, I hate to sound superficial about it, but it's probably that. I mean, and you know, on the musical end of it, that's the kind of thing that a lot of people think of as like, as you know, cliched punk that it's safe to ignore. You know, it's really what DOA was almost doing from the start, and you know, and they pioneered to some degree. So, you know, as people's attitudes to that whole, you know, genre of music have kind of turned and we think that it's goofy, well, they kind of get dumped into that too. I don't think anyone should begrudge them, like, oh, DOA should stay broken up. Like, why? Like, they've had like 17 records or whatever until this point. It's not like if they break up now, they're going to preserve some legacy that they haven't already tampered with by releasing, like, you know, 16 more records after the one that you thought was great.
Adam, do you not like DOA?
No, I do.
Oh! I thought you were coming out as anti-DOA. I was surprised because I thought by law all Canadians had to love DOA. You're being brutally honest, which is fair.
I'm trying to put myself into the head of like people that are going to scoff at DOA doing anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, fair enough. Well, my recommendation is if you see DOA live, you should go see him because it's still a fun show. Also, Joey. Adam might say that Joey's awkward, which may be true, but he's a gigantic man. Like, people don't realize how gigantic Joey Keithley is. He could knock out most people with one punch. I mean, he's huge. Huge. Well,
that's why he's awkward. He's huge. It's weird.
I mean, he's really, really, really big. Really big. Anyway, Adam, should we play a song? What should we do? Let's play a tune.
Yeah. What do you got? What do you got?
You want me to go first? All right, that's cool. Well, Adam just mentioned Eddie and the Hot Rods. A lot of the listeners might not know Eddie and the Hot Rods. And with good reason, they were never super famous in the USA. However, Eddie and the Hot Rods were actually, some people call them pub rock, but I don't think they sound like pub rock. Pub rock is usually like the Faces or even the 101ers. Eddie and the Hot Rods don't sound like that. I would say Eddie and the Hot Rods are more glam rock or proto-punk. They were around from like 73 to like 78, 79, and they existed just before the punk rock did. A lot of the punk rockers were fans, and they kind of paved the way. They were kind of, well, I wouldn't say they necessarily inspired any of the punk rockers, but while the Eagles and while Fleetwood Mac were getting huge, Eddie and the Hot Rods were one of the few bands that were just putting out rocking music. Well, Eddie and the Hot Rods in October are going on a USA tour, which I'm excited about. They've got like three really, really good records, and the records are sort of like proto-punk, sort of punk. They've got like the cover of the second album is Eddie hanging himself, which I think is pretty badass. So just to familiarize the listeners with this, we're going to play a song from their second album. The song is called Do Anything You Want to Do by Eddie and the Hot Rods. And if you like it, you can see them live in October. This is Do Anything You Want to Do by Eddie and the Hot Rods. This is off the CD version out on Cherry Red Records. And honestly, they did a really nice job on the remasters. Let's check it out. And we are back on the Punk News Podcast. I hope you enjoyed Eddie and the Hot Rods. I do. I'm probably going to go. It's not going to be a life-changing show, but it should be fun. Adam, let's talk about something that's quite unexpected, quite weird, quite unusual. There's going to be a tribute album to Black Oak, Arkansas. And people might say, John, who's Black Oak, Arkansas?
Adam, John.
Oh, go ahead, Adam.
Who's Black Oak, Arkansas?
Black Oak, Arkansas is a southern rock band. They're kind of like the western version of Lynyrd Skynyrd. They, you know, it's hard rock, but it's western rock, a little bit of country. They were actually never really that big in the United States. I mean, they sold a fair amount of records. They weren't a nobody band, but they were never as big as like Lynyrd Skynyrd or you know, they're probably not even 1/20th as big as Led Zeppelin. But they had a following, and actually, a lot of people might not know this, I'm pretty sure Greg Ginn says Black Oak, Arkansas is his very favorite band of all time. So, this band called, which I've never heard of, but might be cool, Josephus and the George Jonestown Massacre, they're making a tribute to Black Oak, Arkansas. The interesting thing is that it's got a lot of guests on the album. There's going to be Jeff Clayton of Anti-Scene, Paul Leary and Jeff Pincus of Butthole Surfers, Brian Venable of Lucero, longtime Punk News favorite band, Greg Ginn of Black Flag, and Bill Davis of Dash Rip Rock are on this Black Oak, Arkansas tribute. I don't think this is a tribute anybody saw coming.
I didn't even know this band existed, so there's that. I was going to say, this is too many bands with too many clever names here. When you said it was like Josephus and the George Jonestown Massacre, I was like, I was going to be like, oh, them. Yeah, they're like a... I was going to say they were the Brian Jonestown Massacre, but yeah, that's a different band. So should I know anything by Black Oak, Arkansas? Do you know anything about Black Oak, Arkansas?
You know me. If I see something that, like, actually, Keith Moore, the reason I know a little bit about this band is because Keith Morris once said before punk came along, he listened to the stuff like this, The Tubes, Led Zeppelin. So he listened to all that, like, 70s hard rock. So I got a couple of their albums. It's all right. I mean, honestly, the albums from the 70s, they're all kind of the same. So if you want to check them out, just get any of the records from the dollar bin from the 70s. It's okay. I mean, it's not I think it was probably more mind-blowing in the 70s when hard rock was new, or at least when it contrasted against Fleetwood Mac and the Eagles. It's certainly harder than that, you know. If you like Mountain, you'll like Black Oak, Arkansas.
Was there a hit though? Is there like one hit wondery kind of song that shows up on classic radio or anything like that?
I don't think there is, because honestly, I like that's why they never got huge. I don't have their hit, and I don't recognize any of their hits. Their highest charting single was Jim Dandy to the Rescue, which I listened to the YouTube. I didn't recognize it. So,
I've never heard this band before until we posted this article. Like, never heard of them. Like, not even named. So, yeah.
But that's one of the things about punk rock is you never know what you're going to get.
So what else is going on? You going to any shows? You doing anything?
Yeah,
you
man. Hanging out? I've been talking about this band a lot lately. I just can't. I hope I don't burn myself out. Actually, check this out, man. I've been to a lot of. I thought summer was supposed to be the concert season. There are so many great shows this fall. Let me just run through some of the shows I've been to or I'm going to this fall. I saw The Garden on Friday, which is two twin brothers. I talked about them before. Very primal, very pounding, very raw, nasty punk rock. It's actually the hipster audience, if you will, even though I don't think hipsters are really a thing anymore, but it's like that crowd. But they were way more punk rock. And the opening act was this guy, I guess you would say, called DM Tina. It was this guy dressed up in drag, and he was really drunk, but he like sang over top of like Divine songs and Pete Shelley's Homo Sapiens song, but he like didn't even like sing the right songs. He was wasted and he like fell over. It was like a crazy, crazy show. I saw Kicker on Sunday and it was awesome. Kickers, I talk about this band on Tom and Punky's podcast. Pete the Roadie, it was awesome. This upcoming week, I'm going to see Bad Canoes, which is Marissa Paternoster's band, where it's kind of like the Slits meets the Screamers. I love it. I love it. And I'm also going to see pretty soon the Kettle Rebellion, which is a reunion of the pre-Mischief Brew band that actually was around before Mischief Brew. They've never done a show since they broke up, so I'm super – it's like the proto-Mischief Brew band, so I'm excited to see that.
Really, yeah, we talked about the Kettle Rebellion reunion on the show here before. And Bad Canoes, they did the crazy little MTV 12 feature that we ran on Punk News a few weeks ago.
And we're going to be running a second on October 4th, so if you're into it, check it out. We ran this thing called MTV 12, which is basically just the Bad Canoes playing a bunch of videos that they liked, exclusive on Punk News. The kids were into it. I thought it was a lot of fun. Check it out. How about you, Adam? You going to any shows or anything?
Well, my big like show of the season is next Thursday, which is another date on the Constantine's reunion show, but it's their first big solo show in Toronto since they've been back. So they're playing up there next Thursday. That's, you know, me and the guys from Indoor Shoes, which is my local in town kind of like record label slash, booking agency that books all the good shows around here. Me and those guys are going up for it, so I am really excited for that. Actually, last night I was at a show that Indoor Shoes put on down here, where it was it was being headlined by Single Mothers, who have a record that comes out next week, I think. Probably by the time anyone hears this podcast, their new record is out. And they're open. The show was opened by a band that I've been digging online for a long time, but I hadn't had a chance to see live yet, called Solids. Solids out of Montreal. It's a two-piece, just like guitar and drums. And they play like super reverb-y, you know, really fast, really loud, really like wall of sound level kind of punk rock that they're playing. It's almost shoegazy, just in the way that there's kind of like so much kind of fuzz and guitar craziness kind of happening. Solids is really cool to see. It was one of those bands where like I got up close and I watched them, and then after their set I was like, ooh, my ears are really ringing after this. Like, one day I'm going to regret having done that. But yeah, that was really cool. I'd really wanted to get out and see them. I kind of want to play a solid song. Because I think we talked about them.
Let's do it, baby. Let's do it. Ain't nothing stopping us.
No, I suppose not. So they had a record that came out called Blame Confusion. It came out earlier this year. It was out on Fat Possum in the States. Mm. And I think, I don't know if it was like, who is it on in Canada, but whatever. Fat Possum. That's a cool label. That's what they were on. So this is a song off of that. The song is called Traces. It's by Blame Confusion, two-piece out of Montreal. Whoa, sorry, that was wrong. It's by Solids. The album is called Blame Confusion, two-piece out of Montreal. Boom. There we go. we're back from that. So that was a cool show. The one thing about that show that I actually thought you would really like, and I thought about you a lot as I was watching this.
Oh, well, thank you. Oh, I still got to do the water bucket challenge, Adam.
Is that still a thing?
Yeah, well, you challenged me, and I really wanted to. I had this big scheme on how to do it and everything, but I needed like four people, and I couldn't get four people together to help me do it. So I'm just going to straight up do it. I will do it. It's still a thing.
Is it still a thing? You just spritz yourself or something.
Thank you for thinking of me. I appreciate that. I think about you too a lot, Adam.
Oh, that's romantic. The band that headlined the show was Single Mothers. I don't know if you ever heard Single Mothers, John.
I have not.
You would like them. When I reviewed their EP, or at least talked about their EP kind of for the first time on Punk News, I had my one kind of like my pull quote moment, where you're like the one stupid thing you say on the internet sort of like ends up being a sticker on the band's record or whatever.
Honestly, don't you love that? Like I get
it. It rarely happens to me because I don't write a lot of reviews anymore. But I did something where I kind of compared them to like, where it was almost like the Hold Steady by way of Black Flag with what they were doing, where it was there was this definitely like almost storytelling talking happening during the vocal sections of the songs. But the band is just kind of like raging around like a Black Flag style hardcore band under it. So Single Mothers did a lot of cool stuff like that. And their front man, a guy by the name of Drew Thompson. Drew is one of these. I don't want to say troubled in that he's suffering from some sort of mental illness or anything like that. But I want to say that like incredibly like enigmatic and unpredictable frontman for a band. So after the EP that Single Mothers had came out, they pretty much fell off the map for a little while, and you know, more or less split up. And they split up in that like Drew kind of freaked out, moved up north to a gold mining town in northern Ontario called Swastika. Moved to Swastika in northern Ontario and tried his luck at being a gold prospector. And for whatever reason, that didn't work. So he came back and rejoined his band, and now he's still going. And Drew is this guy that when he's on stage, he's the front man for a band that, you know, he's only singing. So he has the benefit of kind of like having his arms and legs free. He's not encumbered by an instrument or anything like that. And he is a punk frontman in the classic punk frontman mold, in that he's writhing all over the place, and he's kind of like he's mugging for the crowd, and he's you know, making crazy faces and taking things that are in his lyrics and like projecting them onto people, and just you watch him, and it's you know, you see any footage of Johnny Rotten playing back in the, you know, back in the day when the Sex Pistols were together for the first time, when he's just got that thing where you can just see it in his eyes. He's just kind of like glaring at people like a maniac as he's playing.
He's in the zone.
He's in the zone, and like and there's or even there's like a little bit of Iggy in it, where there's kind of like this weird kind of like creeping you out sexuality that's happening with it. Like all that's wrapped up into how Drew performs with Single Mothers. And it's just great to go and to watch a band do that, especially when you go through phases where you see so many bands that almost seem to mimic a certain trend of frontman. I don't know if you ever noticed this, but like every once in a while, there's like a trend in music, and like all the frontmen of all these bands, they end up playing the same sort of way. So there was this phase that we were in. I want to say in, let's say 2002, 2003, 2004, when there were a lot of these kind of like young post-hardcore, I guess they're emo, but not really emo, kind of bands that had formed and were playing. There were like lots of young people starting lots of bands. This is at the time when bands like, say, like, when like Moneen and Silverstein and stuff like that became popular. And you'd go to like a local show, at least I would in Ontario, and you'd see the front men of these bands, and they would all be doing the same shit. So like, you know, they'd be doing this thing that you see like a lot of hardcore guys do, where, you know, where they're singing, and when they're singing, they're kind of like hunch over and throw their other arm behind their back and kind of like curve it up. Right. Right. But you'd go and you'd see like three bands play and all bands sounded the same and all the front men are doing that thing. And it's almost like one of there was some band that got really popular that had that kind of affectation on stage. And then all the little bands that started up following them was like, I'm going to do that thing. And they might not even have done it consciously, but they were doing it. Right. So I love when you see that all the time, where like the front men to like the different like kinds of bands are acting of the genre. So it's nice when I can go see a punk band and like the guy on stage is, yeah, he may be acting of the genre, I guess, but he's acting of kind of like this really like classic crazy frontman thing in punk, which I don't feel that I get to see ever. So yeah, so it's cool. So I thought to myself as they were playing, I'm like, I don't know if John necessarily be into these songs or anything, but John would totally be into this performance.
I bet
it seems like a John performance.
I love the classic crazy front man, like where he's just berserk. He's not even that he's like a tough, violent guy, just where he's like a crazy guy, you know?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's like he's just like I am weird.
Right,
it's,
right.
Yeah, it is that kind of thing that they're projecting. So
you know who's doing good at that along your band too, but the Nightbirds are good at that. Have you ever seen Nightbirds live, Adam?
I've not seen them live, no.
Yeah, actually, Brian Gorsinger is the lead singer of Nightbirds. He used to be in another band. It was like Thrilled to Death or something like that. I've seen Nightbirds 3 times now. He's getting crazier and weirder on stage, which I love. I think it's great. Related, Adam, speaking of, you know, crazy Canadian bands with crazy frontmen, are you a fan of the Vile Tones? Do you know a lot about the Vile Tones?
I have a couple Vile Tones songs on like an old Toronto punk compilation, and I've heard a lot of Vile Tones stuff as reinterpreted by Nardwuar. Because as like the preeminent kind of like punk historian, he's taken Vile Tones songs and done stuff with the Evaporators with them. But I don't have like a Vile Tones full length sitting around or anything like that.
Well, they actually have a compilation called like Taste of Honey, which is like almost every track they ever did. The reason I ask is because the main guy is a pretty wild guy, but he was pretty controversial too. So I was just wondering if you had an opinion on that. But he's like what the classic Canadian crazy guy, you know? So I love crazy. Listen, Punk News Podcast listeners, who is your favorite crazy Canadian? Who's your favorite crazy Canadian? But also, who's your favorite crazy lead singer? I don't mean just, you know, a guy that gets up there and is funny, or a guy that gets up there and plays the acoustic guitar and smiles. I mean a berserker. We're talking your Jellos. We're talking your the polystyrenes. We're talking your Ari Ups. We're talking who else? Who are the crazy guys, Adam? Who are some of the great craziest guys out there? Keith Morris is actually pretty crazy. He gets in that zone. Johnny Rotten. Let's see who else.
See, Johnny Rotten's my favorite example. There's something that I find totally fascinating about his kind of like his onstage persona. You know what I feel like? I feel that like I was robbed of a lot of crazy frontman shit by the kind of bands that got popular when I was like 16. Because you'd go to a show and you'd see like Less Than Jake play, or you'd see Real Big Fish play, or you'd see even Blink-182 play, or one of these bands that were in like that kind of like ska punk, pop punk thing that was happening at the time. And it was like between every other song, it was like cracking jokes.
True.
And it was really like, I'm sure I found it really amusing at the time, but like it was really like frat boyish.
True.
In a sense, it's the chuckle fest at the comedy house kind of thing. Like, and I bands don't really do that kind of like goofy ass banner to the same degree anymore. At least it doesn't feel like they do. But like that was all very samey to me now that I think about it. Like, you almost expect it. Oh, I'm gonna go see some bands. Hope they're funny.
Along those lines, at that same time, hardcore was having one of its resurgence. And when I say hardcore, I mean hardcore, not necessarily hardcore punk. And so those guys really weren't that crazy either. They would like scowl and stomp around on stage, but at all times they're very inconsistent. I mean, frankly, it's a lot of posing. Not that they're posers, but there's a lot of posing in hardcore of that era, you know? So guys that might have been crazier kind of maybe drift towards the more aggressive music, but there's this actual stage is more chugga, 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 and the music is not off the hook. And so the stage performance is not off the hook. I think in order to have a crazy frontman, you have to have some pretty swinging music in the background, you know?
Yeah, I think that's – there's a certain degree where, you know, if you're playing shoegaze, you can't go completely bananas, right? So – well, you could, that might be cool, but it probably doesn't work.
Well, speaking of bands that Adam White is into, let's
wait. Hold on. Oh. I had a whole story that I was prepared to tell you here. Well, I feel like I have to tell you this because I looked it up, and it was really funny to the point where I don't even know if it's true, but it was really funny.
Well, let us hear.
You're supposed to go. Why the hell is there a town in Ontario called Swastika?
Oh, this was me being snooty, not asking that, because Adam's like, there's a town called Swastika, and my expected reaction is like, there's a town called Swastika? How could they say that? But me being snooty, me being, you know, Mr. Ivory Tower, I'm thinking, well, of course there's a town called Swastika, because Native Americans had swastikas too. Not all swastikas means Nazis. Nazis actually stole swastika from several different cultures. That's why there's a town called Swastika. So that's what's going on in my head. I'm all proud of myself that I know the actual origin of swastikas that Nazis...
And you're probably right about the origin, like it was the whole Sanskrit good luck thing, but that's not the funny part of it.
Adam, why is there a town called Swastika in Canada?
So, all right, there were lots of German sounding towns in Ontario, but then once World War II happened, there was this trend for a while where they were going to rename all the German sounding towns because we couldn't have towns with German names at that point. So the biggest of these and the one that stuck is there was a town called Berlin, Ontario, and Berlin got renamed to Kitchener. So Kitchener, it has been ever since, and that's the one that stuck. But they decided that they had to change the name of Swastika, of course, and they changed it to Winston, okay? But then, so it's stuck in Kitchener, but the folks that lived in Swastika, and Swastika is like a small little mining town, like not a lot of people, they're like, fuck that, we're Swastika. So they tore down the Winston sign, put up a Swastika sign again, and then they put up another sign, and I don't know if this is a folk legend or anything, but it's awesome. They put up another sign under it that said, to hell with Hitler, we came up with our name first.
Wait, here we go. Swastika, Ontario. I'm looking up. But it was founded in 1908. Okay, so it was founded in 1908. I wonder if they named them, because I think by 1908, the Germans might have been using the swastika. I don't know.
No, it was definitely, it was a gold mining town, so hey, you want to call it good luck, right? So... You know.
Oh, no, here it is. No, they did name it after the Native American. See, this is it. I find this very interesting. Swastikas have developed independently across many different cultures. And when you think about it, it's not that, like inherently creative of a symbol. It's just like a two, it's an X with extra lines, you know? But Native Americans and the ancient Aryans, when I say Aryans, I don't mean white people. I mean Aryan people from the Indus region out near India and stuff, developed a swastika independently.
Do you say this when you're wearing your Sid Vicious armband and people are getting up in your face?
No, but actually, who was the musician that used to wear a swastika belt buckle and got shit about it all the time? And he had to explain that it was like a Native American thing, so he stopped doing it.
I don't know who that is, but that seems like a poor judgment on his part.
It might have been Neil Young, maybe not. Like, some guy used to wear like a swastika belt buckle, and then was like, how can you wear that? I think he might have even been Jewish. And he's like, this is a Native American thing. I sympathize with the Native Americans, but I can't figure that out. But it's a hilarious story.
If you're wearing a swastika belt buckle, you are essentially wearing a sign that says, ask me about my swastika belt buckle. Because there's no way you can be like, what? No, I don't think of it that way. What do you mean? What do you mean there'd be a negative reaction to it? No. That's not how I meant it at all.
Go ahead, Adam. I'm sorry.
I was doing shtick.
Along those lines, Jello Biafra, who is completely anti-swastika, and he's so much anti-swastika that he even wrote a song about how much he hates the swastika, he's worn that same star belt buckle for like 35 years. I wonder what that belt buckle means. I want to ask him about it sometime or something, but I don't want him to get mad about it. Because like, I think Jello might have a lot of – I have no idea. I think Jello might have a lot of superstitions or something because he's worn like the same belt buckle for like 35 years. It's like a star. And like maybe something like really personal, this is just me making, like maybe it's like what his dying grandma gave to him. And so I'm like, Jello, what's the deal with your belt buckle? He could be like, that's what my grandma gave me, you asshole. But I really want to know the story behind his belt buckle.
Maybe he's really like deathly afraid of people stealing his pants.
It may be, well, you know, there's this famous story about that too. When the Dead Kennedys opened for The Clash, I think this might have been on the London Calling tour. Jello Biafra jumped into the audience. It was the biggest audience that the Dead Kennedys ever played, but it was so huge that they ripped off his jeans. And so by the time he made it back on stage, the only thing he was wearing was his belt and his socks.
The fact that you had a story about that is It's kind of sad, really.
Well, continuing on with our Jello Biafra nudity story, this is a band that Adam likes. Adam, one of your favorite bands, Sonic Avenues, they got a new song out called Teenage Brain. Are you down with this? Are you excited? Well, did you enjoy their latest release called Mistakes?
Mistakes is seriously in my top like three records for the year. I love Mistakes. It is a great pop punk record in the best sense of the word. I love everything about it. If you listen to any of the band's old stuff, it is just like heads and tails better written than any of their old stuff. We've played Sonic Avenues like two or three times on this podcast, I think. Even they're amazing. I love them. This video is super fun. I like the aesthetic that this band keeps putting through in the stuff that they do. It's got a little bit of the kind of wacky Dayglo thing that like the Briefs had done, but maybe not as not I just used the word a second ago, but like not as much kind of shtick as the Briefs did with it. So I like that. I like this. I don't like that they're not touring near me, and that they refuse to tour near me, and I don't really have any way to force them to do that, so I kind of feel powerless. But yeah, so everyone should go on the Punk News and check out the video for the new Sonic Avenues. And I want to say single. It's not a single. It's just the new video that they made for a song off of that record.
Yeah, this band's cool. I always like the high energy punk rock. This is cool. Adam, should we? This is cool. You should check this out. Should we wrap this up, or should we talk about that band that is back when no one thought they would come back? Should we talk about that band, or should we save that for later?
Ooh, this band that is back. Which one are we talking about here? Which one? Hold on. I gotta jog my.
We're talking about the one that has broken my heart, but now I'm back again. I'm back in the fold. I guess we gotta talk about it after this huge buildup.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
We'll make this as brief as possible. Guar has a new vocalist in the band. It's a girl or a woman or however you want to put it. Well, actually, she's an alien, but I guess it's a female alien. She's called Volvatron, and she's one of the newest singers of Guar. Guar's got at least two lead singers now. They've got Blothar, and they've got Volvatron. What's interesting about this is since the death of Dave Brocky and Odorous Urungus, the band has said that they're probably not going to have a single permanent singer, and they're going to have like a rotating cast of singers, sort of like they did in the late 90s when they had like four or five singers on every album. A lot of people kind of...
It seems like a good idea to me.
You mean for any band or for this exact point?
For Guar as... For Guar in particular,
you're absolutely right. Because how can you replace Odorous Urungus? He had such a unique vocal, styling. But further, he's so iconic. Whoever you bring in, like, is not going to be the next Odorous Urungus. So if you make the band more of a troupe than a band, it sidesteps it and pays respects to Odorous Urungus. So I'm excited for this. I think this is going to be cool. I'm excited to see the band live. And I support this. A lot of people are saying, wow, isn't it great that Guar is addressing, is bringing females into rock and roll? But the fact is, Guar has actually always had females in rock and roll and were one of the few bands to have female singers and female members during the late 80s and early 90s when there were almost no girls at all in hardcore and heavy metal. I mean, they had Slymenstra Hyman in the band from 89 till 2002, but they even had a few Guar, they called them Guar women before then, who would sing and be part of the band. So, I mean, really, you have to give credit to Guar that Guar has been pro-feminism or pro-females the entire time. And this is cool. I'm down with this.
I was just thinking about, like what other band could make that kind of transition where you transition from, say, having a strong frontman into having like kind of a collective, because like collective, like on paper, that seems like a really good direction to go in. Cause it kind of, it does solve that problem. You aren't going to bring in one person to replace, one person that seems irreplaceable. You're going to accept that person's irreplaceable and you're going to kind of change what you do and, have a bunch of people that come in and kind of do it and celebrate it. And I'm thinking like who else could do that in a way? And this is a really weird example, but like in a way, although they totally fucked this up, Sublime did that. Because
with a Long Beach Dub All-Stars.
Right? Where those guys would go out and they would play Sublime songs, and they would play their own songs that were kind of written in the Sublime style, and they kind of had Sublime people involved, but they would go out and they would have, like, you know, collections of people. They would have guests that would show up and do songs. They would have different members of the band singing on different things. And it was a way that, you know, if you were a big Sublime fan, you could go, this is a bad choice of words, but you could get your fix, right?
Good night, everybody.
Right? Good night. But without having to, you know, embarrassingly try to replace a popular frontman. Now, of course, they fucked that up because they got that Rome guy and reformed Sublime, and right? So, you know, best intentions and all that. But while Long Beach Dub was around, that seemed like the best way that you could do that.
Yeah, actually, I mean, Long Beach Dub All-Stars was not a great band. Like, they had the hippie side of Sublime, but they did not rock out like Sublime. But on paper, it was great because they had, like, all the Sublime, like contributors, like the side guys. But they also would bring in, like, guys that influenced Sublime. Like, HR did some tracks with them. So did Barrington Levy. So did – was it Ika Mouse or was it the other guy? I think it was Ika Mouse. Was it Ika Mouse? No. It was not Little John, not Ika Mouse. Oh, I can't remember his name. The other dance hall guy. Well, I can't remember his name. But I know Barrington Levy was one, but they had one, Half Pint. They brought in Half Pint to do some songs with them, which was cool. But, I mean, Adam, why wasn't Long Beach Dub All-Stars that good? I love Sublime. Do you like Sublime? I love Sublime.
I have turned against it.
Why?
I was into it back when I was into a lot of third wave ska, and I was actually into Long Beach Dub when Long Beach Dub came out.
Really?
And I remember seeing them when they played one of the Warp Tours back in the day after the first Long Beach record came out, and I was really into it. And I thought that the performance that they put on was, you know, I felt really good about it. Like, it felt really good. It felt like it was like paying tribute to Bradley kind of thing. It's one of those bands that whenever I hear them now, it's always I can't get the dumb frat guy thing out of my head.
True,
it's like the fans of that band have slowly over the years, not even the real fans of the band, let's say the
greatest hits fans,
the stereotypical fans of the band who don't necessarily exist but we all believe exist. They have ground any of my caring out of me, and I just can't do it at this point. Like, I feel that like I've heard those songs enough that if I never hear those songs again, I'm probably cool. So it's one of those things.
Well, Adam White coming down hard on Sublime. I love Sublime. I don't think you can blame them for their fans. If you actually like listen to Sublime, they do some really clever stuff, you know, blending Grateful Dead with Descendants, with Falling Idols, with Mudhoney, with all these disparate influences, with the reggae, with Wailing Souls. I love Sublime. No matter.
Oh, don't. You're trying to beat the hate out of me. I made my peace with this.
Give in to the hate, Adam.
Yeah. No, you're trying to tell me to not give in to the hate.
Adam,
already given in to the hate, John.
Let us pray the hate away. Adam, you have one last song for us tonight on tonight's podcast.
Yeah, I don't think there's any prayer involved in it, but let's see. Hold on, I got a whole bag of tricks here that I had put together. So what else are we gonna pull out to play? So we played Solids. That was a lot of fun. All right, let's do something. Let's do something off base here. So I went out and did some record shopping lately, John.
Oh, What'd you get?
I got some stuff that people would expect me to get. I grabbed the reissue of the last Constantine's record that came out, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, that's not, everyone's heard me talk about that kind of shit. The one thing that I saw where I was just like, ooh, I don't have that on vinyl, and I probably wouldn't necessarily find it anywhere, was a copy of the fourth and final record by Calgary-based instrumental surf rock band Huevos Rancheros.
Called
Muerte del Toro, or, ooh, I don't know, Death of the Bull, I guess. I can't speak Spanish. But anyways.
Muerte del Toro would be Death of the Bull, yeah.
Yeah, all right. So I don't know if I'm pronouncing these things right. But anyways, though, that record came out in 2000 on Mint. which is the label out of Vancouver or Victoria, one of the two, British Columbia, that they've released basically all of Nardwuar's stuff in the past little while, but they released, like, people would have known them kind of back in like the early pop punky kind of days of, like, they released things by like Cub and Mao. They released the first New Pornographers record. Mint's an awesome label. But anyways, though, so this is so I picked up that on vinyl, and I was super happy about it because, like, they're truly one of those bands that I'm pretty sure, unless you are like a certain Canadian music nerd of a certain age that happens to have maybe been going to shows in like the few short years when this band was playing, there is absolutely no reason for you to have ever heard of them. So I'm really stoked that I had it because I was just assumed I would never see any of their vinyl cross my path. I don't even know if there is any vinyl outside of this record. But yeah, so this is from that. The song I'm going to play is a cover. It is a cover of the 1959 surf rock classic Moondog by the Gamblers. So this is Huevos Rancheros in 2000 and their version of Moondog, which they have titled Moondog 2000. Moondog!
Back on the Punk News Podcast, and that was some funky, dunky, lunky, wacky, hijacky instrumental surf rock. I'm down with it. I love Huevos Rancheros, Country Eggs. It was cool, man. Adam White, let's wrap this bad boy up. If you have any comments or questions or suggestions, feel free to email us at podcast@punknews.org. I know Adam White is thinking maybe we'll change the format up a little bit. Maybe we'll do different shows in the Punk News Podcast. If you're happy with the format, if you want a different format, let us know. Send us your ideas. podcast@punknews.org. Adam White, I'm so happy that you and I could just bro down again like we could in the old days.
Yeah, this was easy. It probably is way too much talking than I needed to do given this onset of a cold. So I'm probably going to hang up Skype and then go like heave blood all over the floor. But hey.
Well, Adam, have fun purging. And once again, thanks for listening to the Punk News Podcast. We'll see y'all next week.